Wonderful. So thanks everybody for joining me this afternoon. I genuinely feel a little bit like a kid at Christmas today. It is such an honor to be joined by this panel that I'm going to introduce to very shortly. But first of all, I figure I'd tell you a little bit about me and a little bit about the event and what you can expect from today. So, hi, I'm Kira. I'm a 26-year-old dog-obsessed British recruiter. I've been living in New York for the last 2 years. I've spent 6 years in recruitment, and 3 of those years have been focused on specializing in the technology space. So predominantly, I focus on software and data engineering. And at the start of 2020, instead of making a New Year's resolution to go to the gym that I was never going to stick to, I decided to make a pledge to do more to lift up and amplify minorities in tech. As well as working with startups and some larger organizations on creating and implementing strategies for their recruitment processes, starting to sort of bridge the gap for underrepresented minorities in the tech space. And just with everything that's kind of been going on this year, I feel as though this is a really important and hard-hitting topic. And in terms of our guests, they have a lot of experience, a lot of value to add, and some pretty interesting stories to share as well. Now, today's all about learning and empowerment. You know, we're not here to preach or to scold, only to sort of help identify potential microaggressions and areas for development in the workplace. And, you know, hopefully it resonates with some of you and helps others along the way. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to our guests. So Neetu, we'll start with you, if you don't mind. Could you just take a couple of minutes and introduce yourself and give us a little bit more information about your background, and we'll go along the panel.
Sure. Thank you. And thank you, Kira, for organizing this. I'm the VP of Engineering at Oscar Health. I've been there for about 7 months. And before Oscar Health, I worked on my own startup for a bit. And then before that, I've spent a bunch of time at Microsoft. I was at Microsoft for 18 years, and then I was at Conductor, which is an organic SaaS marketing company, for 5. And I'm very excited to be here. In fact, as a rule, anytime I have an option to be in a panel or a conversation or a discussion where it can be seen that there are people like me, I try to show up. I certainly had not met any women CTOs or CPOs until very recently. When I first got the job, I actually tried to find some metrics to say what percentage of companies had women CTOs. And I didn't find any, so I made up a number of 3. Then I actually met a few, but it was so hard to find even a metric to say what percentage of women actually lead technology at different places. But now I'm thankful. There are, in fact, a lot, and I'm very thankful for having met a few of them. So I'm happy to be here. I will answer pretty much any question anybody asks me, even if it's uncomfortable. So bring it on.
Thank you so much for having me on the panel. My name is Anna. I'm the Senior Director of Talent and DE&I at Frame.io. I'm originally from France, as maybe you can hear a little bit, and I moved to the US 9 years ago. I have a pretty untraditional background. I studied law in France, and then I moved here to pursue a singer-songwriter career. So that's what I did for my first few years in the US while doing a lot of other jobs, of course, because that's usually not sustainable. So I was mostly waitressing, babysitting, teaching guitar. That's how I was able to get my green card as a singer-songwriter, which allowed me to look for a full-time job. So I can share some stories, because it was obviously not the most appealing resume that I had looking for a job in tech. And I've been working in the tech space for about 6 years, and pretty much since the beginning have been focused very heavily on diversity and inclusion, probably also, again, because of my experience job searching and seeing all the things that seemed to have too much significance when it probably didn't. So I figured once I get in, I'm going to see if I can help get more people in this world that maybe have an untraditional background or didn't have equal access to opportunities growing up. And so that's what I've been actively focused on over the last 6 years.
Perfect. And Dalji, over to you.
Hey, thank you for inviting me, Kiera. This is always a pleasure to be in a group of leaders who are actually so passionate about diversity and inclusion. I have a very traditional background. I did my master's in computers. I started my career with IBM. Was with IBM for 14 years. Actually, I was there when Ginny was the CEO. So I was in a company where the top boss was woman. So I definitely saw the trickle-down impact on diversity and inclusion initiatives at IBM. And my last job was with Priceline.com, and now I'm director of engineering at Compass. Basically, I think from my own experiences, I have seen the obstacles women face and all the female engineers that report into me in my org. I have seen the challenges they still face in 2020. It's always nice to talk about these small steps that we can take to make it better for the next 5 years, next 10 years, next 20 years. So I hope to do my part. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. So just so everybody knows what we can expect from today, it's a roundtable. It's an open discussion. We have no preset questions or answers. So we would just love your honesty and transparency and your genuine thoughts on everything. So I'm going to open it up to the panel now and just get like a brief overview in your opinion about what the current state of diversity in tech is right now.
I can say something pretty brief, but my take is that I would say it's still not great and that we probably shouldn't settle for anything less than perfect equality, but that it is still a lot better and it's getting better, even in my very short amount of time, in the last 6 years, that I'm seeing the progress and awareness raising. And so I am very optimistic that things are moving in the right direction, but also want to make sure that we don't get blinded by the progress and can keep focusing on making it just as equitable as possible.
Yeah, I would like to add that, you know, it's not perfect, but it's so much better than before. So I would take two examples, basically, right, from I was reading RBG's, some of the articles on her, right? And one thing was that in 1970s, women had to have a different door to enter the same hall with their colleagues, right? So at least the doors are open now. So we are so much better than in 1970s. But again, we have this COVID situation when women are 8 times more likely to leave a job because now they have these additional responsibilities. So definitely we are not where we are supposed to be, and we cannot give up now because this is not the time to give up. This is the time to actually do more because we are taking some steps back given the situation we are in, which is sort of out of our control. But what we can control is not take any step back and just try to keep moving towards what we were doing for so many years.
Mm-hmm. I think the current state of diversity is actually going backwards. I think it's been going backwards for a little bit and it's continuing. You know, it feels like we definitely talk about it a whole lot more. But I think for sure maybe the organizations have picked the distribution of women to men looks a little bit different than it did when I first started, but there is not a lot of distribution in skin color. And it is extremely disheartening, actually. And you can see it as you go higher up. I mean, there are, like, we probably have a pretty good percentage of like entry level engineers who tend to have a bit more diverse background, but once they are in an organization for a while, we start losing them. And I think we're doing something wrong we're definitely doing something wrong in somewhere between like hiring them and like not getting them to the next third level, not the next level. I think it's easier to find tech leads and engineering managers, but it's so much harder to find senior directors and VPs and architects and principal and staff and CTOs and CEOs with that. Like, it dramatically decreases as the levels change. And I think 10 years in, a lot of women leave tech. They leave tech even before COVID, but they definitely leave after. Like, there's a whole, I've lost people because COVID, and they had a baby and they just couldn't figure out how to do it. And we tried a bunch of different creative options. I think that is a blot in my career. But either way, I think we're losing people somewhere after they're past their entry level jobs. We are not supporting them somewhere, or we're not encouraging them.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I was speaking with a director of engineering who mentioned that they've actually brought in like an anti-racist consulting group to help provide training and leadership for a lot of the engineering managers that they have, so that it's not just about attracting engineers from diverse backgrounds, but what are we doing to support these individuals? Why are individuals grading out at a lower level than their white male counterparts are? Like, are we overgrading or undergrading? Like, but whatever the situation is, we need to be able to look internally at what we're doing. So I think that's a really great point, Neetu. And, you know, we are talking about it more. It's something when I started my career, I was always the only woman in an office most of the time. And I didn't even think about it, you know.
And you're 26, so you started yesterday.
I know. So
you know, started decades before you, and it was the same situation.
Yeah. But you are so right. The conversations are happening. And I feel like Daljeet mentioned something really interesting about her daughter, if you don't mind sharing that anecdote about how the younger generation are.
Yeah, for sure. So this was an incident actually last week when I was driving her to her swim practice or something, and there was a board said men at work, and immediately she's 10, right? So she reads everything she sees. She reads like men at work. What about women? So that was her immediate like question, and no context. We are just sitting in the car driving. So this is where I feel like when as human beings, when we start our lives, we don't really think about these things and how there's this society and the systemic subtle things that happen throughout our lives that actually tell us that, oh yeah, women are different, our skin color is different, so this is different, right? So these differences are being taught to us throughout our lives with these subtle messages from media, from posters, from everything. And that actually constitutes most of the unconscious bias that happens at workplace today, right? Because growing up, when you see these small things, and I couldn't tell her anything more than, oh, maybe there are no women in this place. Maybe women are working on the other street or somewhere else where there is a board that said women at work. So maybe there are only a couple of men working on this construction site. So that's the only answer I could come up with immediately. But these are the subtle messages that actually we are passing still in 2020 to the next generation.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I was thinking about this also last time I went to ski, and at the snow park, you know, where people do the cool thing, it's there's a big sign that says like, don't be that guy. And I remember thinking like, oh yeah, because of course to be able to do cool tricks you'd have to be a guy, like what is the sign, you know? And it's just all of these things which I know we talked in our previous chat about like microaggression and everything, but these things add up, right, to keep sending this the messages and the signs that you don't belong if you don't meet the word term. Or I know, Neetu, you were talking about race, and like in the media, software engineers have been represented as a white guy with a hoodie in his basement, right?
Like they're all like Mark Zuckerberg.
Yes. And so it's been portrayed like this everywhere. And so all of the generation growing up and watching it, if you don't look like this, you don't identify. And so then the people going into this career, they're like, look like this, right? Like, there's no role models.
And it also very, very much shows up even like the actual terminology when you're writing code. You know, think about servers that host the data and ones that replicate and serve the data. Like the actual terminology that's used all the time is master slave. Now imagine a person who's got history with those words, and like, how do you ask those people to deal with that, or the whitelist and the blacklist? What the fuck? Sorry.
Yeah. No, but you're totally right. We actually did a whole initiative to like change the wordings of a lot of that with the whitelist, blacklist, and master, and like all of these things. Just we need to rethink so much of like, we need to put our like 10-year-old cap on and just be like, wait, why is this? You know, because like so many things we've just taken for granted, like, oh yeah, that's what it is, you know, because that's the day to day and you're not going to fight everything, but it does matter. And yeah, I think it's worth rethinking a lot of these things that come from a place of inequality and discrimination. Mm-hmm.
So thinking about that, obviously we've come a certain way. It sounds like we've still got quite a long way to go. But you know, in your own experiences, what is actually the importance of diversity in tech for those who perhaps just think, well, you know, if they're right for the job, they're right for the job. It doesn't matter who they are or what they look like. Like, what would you say is the importance of it?
That's an answer I really don't like. Every time support manager, I'll usually ask them, what does diversity mean to you? And really when the answer of like, oh, I don't see gender, I don't see color, I hire the best person. Usually my follow-up question is like, oh, wow, how did that work out for you? Like, what's the composition of your current team? Because that's amazing, right? Like you grew up outside of society, no bias, no nothing. That's like amazing for you. So, and it's usually like, oh yeah, I guess now I think about it, currently my team is all white men, but like I would totally hire, you know, not white men. Like, yeah, but it didn't happen. So sorry, it was just a bit of a segue, but I think that that part is really an interesting answer because it's a bit sort of lying to ourselves and pretending that there's no bias involved for all of us, I think is not helping anyone. Because we're not then taking part of our responsibility in the some of the problems that we have today, and we're not taking any steps towards fixing it by just pretending like it's not there.
Accepting that we have a problem is the first step to fixing anything, and I've seen this several times with managers where they don't realize what is the team composition and they don't really pay attention to their team composition. So when they are, say, being presented 10 resumes or 10 candidates, they never think about, oh, my team needs more diverse candidates. Now is the time that I need to think about it, right? Yes, they will do the same thing for the team composition on experience level. They are the ones, they will say, oh, I have 5 junior engineers and I need 1 staff and now I need 2 seniors. So they do that. So it's not that they can't do it. They do that for levels and skills all the time. They will go, oh, I have 3 front end, I need 4 back end. So when you are able to do it in one place, why don't you take that and understand that it is important to do it for your team's culture, and not just team culture, for your business. Like for startups, for example, it is so important to have diverse perspective on the tech side. For sure, on the product and people like business analysts, you need diverse background to talk to your customers. But on the engineering side, if you don't have, say, diverse ideas, you're going to end up with a platform or with a product that is not going to support your variety of customers that you might have, right? So I work at Compass, and majority of our customers are women because our customers are real estate agents, right? So now I go and think, if the teams here don't have enough female engineers, what are those ideas that we are missing? Because that will impact so much for our customers, because majority of them are women, right? So think about who your customers are. And sometimes I've used this sort of trick to convince my CTO or CPO or whatever, right, in my previous jobs, that, oh, I need budget for this and this event for women who code or whatever. And getting that budget allocated in January is like, it's also important for business, right? As much as it's important for culture. So I've used that trick sometimes.
Actually, there's real research that's been done in terms of like the actual value of companies that were either founded by women or have women founders or have diverse teams and over a period of time, or just not actually not just gender diversity, in fact, like all diversity. And there has been like actual research that and data that backs the fact that they are in fact over time way more valuable as a company, just like straight up dollars and cents, right? Apart from the fact it is just the damn right thing to do and we should all do it. The other thing I wanted to build on was what Daljeet said, which is I, as an engineer, and I suspect a whole bunch of you also value a lot what innovation is and value a lot problem solving in new and creative ways. And when you have a group of people which is exactly the same background, they're going to think in parameters that are the same for all of them. So even I think the group itself is a less diverse group is limited in the possible options they would even consider for solving any problem. You know, my kind of tongue-in-cheek example is if you hire a very busy mom, you can be guaranteed your service is going to stay up and it's going to have great like alerting and monitoring and self-healing because she doesn't want to deal with it when she goes home. She doesn't want to be available. So I think even the possibility of options is going to be limited if you don't have diversity of thought in your group, and which it only comes from diversity of experiences.
Yeah, I totally agree. And just for in tech specifically, I think, so first of all, not to get to like philosophical or whatever, but I often think like we're on this planet for, you know, certain amount of time, and I'm at the end, what will we have done, right? Like, what did we fight for? What will we have left in the world? And I'm thinking like equality and equal opportunities for everyone, regardless of their circumstances in which they were born and what they look like, seems like a pretty good fight to pick. And then for tech specifically, it matters so much because it's one of the highest paying industry. And so diversity in tech, and then in media, which we can talk about, like is so critical because it helps sort of further that. And really, when we talk about like the new moms who will stop working, like often they are in lower paying jobs. And when it's time of like, oh, one parent should stay home because it's becoming too much work, the person who will stay home is the person who's has the lowest income. And so that's also why I think diversity in tech is so critical out of all industries, because it gives an opportunity for people to start building their career and their income, and sort of have a different position in the world and sort of help with that gap. So I think that's a really important industry to do that with.
Yeah, definitely. And I hope I'm not overstating here, but for each of you, you know, the reason that I've been connected with you for as long as I have, and, you know, even though we've not necessarily worked together in a professional capacity, I've always been really interested in maintaining a relationship because I consider you from an outsider looking in to be trailblazers in your industry. Like Neetu, I've been following you throughout the pandemic, like just how vocal you've been and how supportive you've been. And to me, it's been astonishing to see that you are leading a team, scaling a team and still giving back. And Daljeet, I know that you're a mother of two and have kind of battled with an intense commute, an intense workload, an unbelievably busy startup. And Anna, you've always been a huge ambassador. And after our first meeting, you know, just understanding more about unconscious bias, I kind of went home and I was telling everyone, I was like, did you know this? And did you know this? So, you know, you guys have all got great experiences. So, you know, specific to either your current workplace or previous workplaces, what like specific benefits, you know, one or two things have you actually seen after driving an initiative around diversity? What's been the impact in your teams?
It has been, I'm naturally an introvert, but actually being outspoken and being present and being visible, I think has given people a bunch of different options to consider. They didn't have to assume that a woman couldn't be in the spot, so they could actually visualize them in a position that was different than, and I'm not making this up, I've been actually told this. So where I actually seeing that you can be a mom and you can run a very large team and you can be obsessed with tech and still be a good mom, and cooking is also okay. So like actually merging what is traditionally feminine and what is like taught us to be masculine, those traits, you can merge them in whichever way is convenient to you. So actually being able to explicitly say, yep, I can write code in dresses just as well as, you know, sweatshirt. I think that's been pretty amazing. And just in my career lifetime, I remember like most women not wearing any dresses when I first started. And now they're coders walking around in beautiful Rent the Runway outfits. And that is just amazing to me. Like just being able to be themselves and do the things that they are, like doing is the only thing that I think all feminists want, which is, it's not about I want to be in tech. It's about what I want to do, whatever I want to do. So I'm pretty enthused about that.
That's such a good example. I was going to bring that up too, but that to me, the real benefit is that creating role models. So in, and allowing people to be able to project themselves and that sense of belonging, because the least we can have people being the only one in the room so repeatedly, the more it becomes just, that's the norm. And then also the more we create a culture of allyship where hopefully people who maybe are not from underrepresented background go back to their home and are like, oh, you know what? Like, this is what I did at work. This is what, and we had an allyship panel, internal panel last week. And really I was almost tearing up, but one of our, you know, employee who's a straight white man, who's a great ally, told us how from the previous panel, he then went home and told his children about what he had learned about like allyship, and how he had also even talked to his dad about things. And it was just like, that's so amazing. Like, this is, if it can spread beyond the workplace and really people can take it home and think about it, think how they raised their children, think how, what message they send, and just be great allies also. I think that's pretty special. And I know for one of the things I'm most proud of in my time at Firm.io is when I started, there was 11% women in management. So I figured I'm going to work on that. And we're now at 47%. And that's just been amazing. And having the women who were there when I first started, like, you know, ping me when they see like that number going up and being like, I can tell you, like, now I'm thinking that maybe eventually I want to take that path, or like having those role models again has just been just really, really exciting.
Yeah, that's amazing. And congratulations, by the way, that is a phenomenal achievement. Now, Dalji, you touched on it earlier, but obviously, you know, 2020's been crazy for a lot of reasons, and I'll try avoiding any of the buzzwords that we've heard over and over again. But we did unfortunately lose an inspiration and a role model in RBG this year. And I think, you know, her passing has sort of highlighted why now more than ever we need to continue striving for equality and equal rights across all minorities, and specifically, you know, within the STEM world. If we think about the bigger picture, you know, what, Dalji, do you think is sort of making the greatest change in recent times, and how do we ensure that we kind of maintain that momentum?
I think I would like to start with what I remember reading recently about RBG, when someone asked her, when will you be happy? At what percent of female judges in Supreme Court will make you happy? And she said all 9 of them, because she said if for 150 years it was all men, it has to be all women for another 150 years, and then I will be happy. Right? So it's like never done, right? It's from 11% to 47% to 100%, it's just never done. And I totally agree with what Neetu and Anna are saying. Like, having those role models actually is definitely helping the younger generations to see that this can be done, right? This is possible. You could be a mom and a CTO. You could be going on a maternity leave, come back and get that promotion that you were about to get before you got pregnant, right? You can do that. And I've seen that happen in like last year. I've seen like a couple of promotions when people came back from maternity leave and got promoted to engineering manager and stuff. And I always think like, yeah, this is what I want to show to my team. This is what when diverse candidates and female engineers join my team, they need to see this, that this is possible. If they are ever want to go into an engineering management path, they shouldn't think that, oh, this is that 10 years of my career and then I get married and have children and then I have to, you know, go slow or take it easy, however you want to speak, right? And this is very recent. These are the changes I've seen in like last 4 or 5 years, which are amazing. And the impact that is having on the people who are joining the workforce now, we will see that, as Neetu was saying, that it was hard to just come across a woman VP of engineering. And now we know several VPs, several CTOs who are women. So it's just in the last 5 years, the changes we have seen is just tremendous.
Yeah, and like RBG obviously talked a lot about, like she had a very supportive partner. And I think that is something also that is critical, talking about straight couples specifically, because historically the gender dynamic have been so set. And I think as we're talking about parental leave and all of that, like I think it's so critical that the norms change so that the men, I guess, for straight couples, like will can also stay at home and take care of the children, or split the load equally so that the woman doesn't have to do double to the point that she can't take it anymore and can't do both, right? So I think having those really supportive partner who can step up at home is critical in gender equality in the workplace, because if the balance is completely off at home, it's just unsustainable, right? And in terms of biases, I had read something so disheartening that when men bring up in an interview that they have children, it makes them seem more positively, not even the same. I'll be like, oh, wow, they're, you know, have responsibilities and I don't know. And then when a woman brings it up, it's like, oof, probably, you know, she won't be able to be focused at work and will be seen more negatively. And that, I think, like the bias has to change. And then the function, I think, also have to change to become more equitable and real split of real partnership in terms of split of responsibility. Or it could go one way or the other, right? But becoming a real choice, right? But men want to stay at home. Like my dad was a stay-at-home dad. My mom was the breadwinner. So I know I had an unusual framework. But it could be, and then it could be the woman stay at home, take care of the children, if that's what really fulfills the person. But it should really be a choice and not a fake choice of societal expectation put on people, I think.
I just want to highlight a couple of things that you mentioned, and they resonate. So in our home, my husband is the primary caregiver. So I have, wait, please leave. he's also a software programmer who gave up his career so I could have mine. We have two kids and he's the primary caregiver for them. And that's how I can do what I do. So it definitely happens only if you have support. And honestly, it only happens that way regardless of which person in a relationship is actually aiming for the stars. I think everybody needs support because you can't do everything by yourself. And a couple other things. I find the one quote from RGB that is the most motivating for me is, she said, if they don't open a door for you, find a window. So I find that to be such a perfectly analogous thing to like iterative sprint planning and exercise, because it's just like, it's okay. Just keep moving forward. Just keep moving forward as much as you can and just keep pushing. So it may not be that we can, you know, I don't know, maybe we will, that we can get everything that we want in a society in our lifetime, but we have to keep pushing. So I found that to be one of the most inspiring things. It's like, all right. And I am thankful that RGB did what she did. I don't think my life exists without her. Like, you know, in the 70s, women had to get permission to open a bank account. So I'm glad none of us have to do that anymore. but I can't thank her enough. And like, I think the best way we can honor her and people like her and the work that they've done is by just keeping it on, you know, keep pushing.
And it's fascinating because obviously, Neetu, like you said, you know, I am only 26. So when I hear about these things, you're thinking, oh, this must have been like a really long time ago. And then when you're like, wait, no, it's not. Like, it's been incredibly recent. And obviously, you know, just given our backgrounds, we're focusing predominantly sort of on the issues of gender. But, you know, you even trace that back to the issue of race and how recent that sort of segregation at its most extreme, you know, what you know, people my age, my friends think about as a long time ago. It's like, no.
February. It was yesterday.
And every day from there. But, you know, it's fascinating to speak with people, you know, as a woman myself that is ambitious. And, you know, I also want a family one day, but to know that you don't have to choose. You can choose both and you can want both for yourself and deserve both for yourself. And I think software engineering is an incredibly challenging career. It is something that I have the utmost respect for. I work in tech, but I think that what you guys do is wizardry. I think it's phenomenal. And I think that, you know, the more women at a younger age that are given role models like yourselves and Anna, the work that you're doing to help kind of elevate more female leaders means that Dalji, you know, your daughter will grow up, you know, and when it comes time to think about college, she's not just becoming a software engineer because that's what her mom does. It's because that's what all of her friends want to do as well. So I think it's really great. And talking about role models is fantastic. Something slightly different, and I'm sure you guys have all got wonderful stories to share, but I'd be really interested to hear about any experience you've had. Neetu, perhaps we'll start with you, just where you've perhaps been, you know, a singular female where you felt either underrepresented or treated differently due to your gender and how you overcame it. And don't say every day, but just generally speaking.
So I'll pick an example from a recent past. And I'll pick this one because I feel like I was already grown up by then. There are many examples from before when I was a really young engineer and it's like, you're the only one in the room and you don't say anything. And maybe you don't say anything because you're the youngest engineer, or maybe you don't say anything because you've been taught not to say anything, or at least you picked up on that social cue of like, be quiet and be, you know, get along. But when I first got promoted to the CTO position, got into the C-suite, every single person in the C-suite at one point or another had a friendly chat with me and asked me how I can be a mom and a CTO. And all of those people were men and parents also. These are all guys who were dads. They were asking me, how is it possible for me to be a mom and a CTO? It's like, really, you are asking me this, like, why? Like, and then given that by then I had already grown up enough, I was like, the same way your dad and in the C-suite also. It's like, it's no different. But that was like very interesting. That was only in the last couple of years, you know? So, it still happens. And, you know, to be like completely fair, some of them are my allies and my friends. And some of those conversations were truly, honestly friendly. And I didn't take them in a bad way. I just took them as like research. They were just doing research into something that was new and different for them. But there were definitely other ones that were like, I don't see how this is a possibility. So
I feel like with so many of the things, like when we had talked about this before, but like with microaggression or however we want to call them, but so much of the things that when being underrepresented, gender, race, sexual orientation, all of that, that we face is the everyday little things. And I know that when taking on its own, people sometimes feel like, oh, this is a bit overreacting, like, oh, it's not a big deal. But it is a big deal because it literally adds up to every day, right? It's like getting that little drop in your forehead, like at the same place one time is okay. Like 100 times you'll get like a little bruise, right? And so that's kind of, I think, what happens with the microaggression and how sometimes people can dismiss it. And I feel like there's so many things that, again, we've just settled. It's just day to day, right? Like when people will bring the check, right? And you're having dinner with maybe your man partner and they bring the check to the man. And I'm always really annoyed, right? I'll be like, I'll make a point, even if we're actually going to split, right? I'll be like, I'm paying for this, right? And it's every time it is a little something. And I remember actually we went to a really nice restaurant. It was in Europe, a bit more old school. But we went to a really nice restaurant one day and I was like, I wanted to invite him. And they brought the two menus. One menu had the prices on them for him and one menu without the prices for me. And I see it and I was like, oh, wait, I don't have the prices. And he's like, oh, I do. And I'm like, wait, what? It's like, no, that's weird. And so I told him, I was like, hey, seems to be a mistake. Like my menu doesn't have prices. It's like, oh yeah, we're really like traditional and that's why. And I was like, okay, can I just get the menu with prices? Like I'm going to pay for this. And they said no. So I really wanted to leave, but I didn't. And again, those situations are always hard and it could feel in the moment, be like, oh, she's overreacting. But it's like, no, this is so wrong, right? Like this, because again, it's another sign, like a woman couldn't pay for it, which means she couldn't make that much money, which anyway, I gave back my menu and we shared the menu. But it was just, again, a small example, right? Or I'm sure so the women on the call might have experienced this where you're like giving a really serious argumentation or about to give a presentation and maybe someone will make a comment on like your hair or your appearance or something that really has nothing to do with that. It just, it's again, it's subtle. Maybe it's even well-intentioned, but in the moment, it really just destroys a little bit of authority you were trying to have in that moment by bringing you back to your physical appearance. And just to share one example I actually had, like, I was having a pretty an argument with someone and with a man, and he imitated me back to me with an imitation of my accent as well. And I was just so caught off guard. So I was like, yeah, I really basically don't think we should do this. And he's like, I really don't think we should do this or whatever it was. And I'm like, I haven't been trained to deal with this, right? I was just like, almost I had just a bug moment, right? Because I'm just like, I don't even know what how to address it, what to do. This is just so. And so I think I was just like, okay, moving on. But I feel like we have so many moments like this. And afterwards you're like, oh, I should have said something. That was not cool, right? But yeah, I think there's just, again, so many examples that, and then the bigger examples, but of those little tiny things that do add up that keep reinforcing we're not equal. We're not being treated the same. And again, just focused on gender because that's my closest experience, but that's the same for talking to all of my other colleagues from underrepresented groups.
And Anna, I think you mentioned last time we spoke when talking specifically about Black software engineers, that it was that they needed to, quote, tone down their Blackness. Like what does that mean? Like how is that an appropriate conversation to ever have with anybody, you know? And I think I believe that first of all, nobody wants to be called sexist and nobody wants to be called racist or, you know, anything to that ilk. I genuinely believe that the majority of people, it comes from lack of information and lack of understanding because it isn't necessarily something that they've had to face or overcome. But I think that it's really important that you continue to highlight perhaps some of these, you know, like we say, microaggressions, where it's like, hey, you know, no one's going to turn around and say you're a terrible person or you're really inappropriate or anything like that. But let me just explain how this could make someone feel, or how that becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy for somebody and a, like a limiting factor for them. So I think, yeah, I mean, Dalji, I'm sure, you know, as an engineering manager and you know, having engineers on your team and reporting into you, you've had experiences. Have you ever had to become an advocate or a champion for perhaps a minority in your team that didn't have a voice for themselves?
Yeah, many times. I feel like these, what Anna is saying, these subtle examples when I either I faced that myself or I saw someone else having that, right? So an example I could think of is, and this is very common, right? When you're interviewing and sometimes you do two-on-one kind of interview where you have two people interviewing one candidate and the person answering is always answering to the men, right? Not to the women. Like even if like the woman is asking the question. So I saw that someone in my team told me about this after the interview, and then I started making sure that I introduce the panel to the candidate upfront. So this happened with someone who was actually the boss of the man who was interviewing with her. So she was the EM, this guy was the tech lead, and they were interviewing a white man, right? And the candidate is always answering to the tech lead, not to the engineering manager. So I always made sure that I introduce them initially and say, who has more authority there? Because maybe it's just unconscious. Maybe they are, I don't know why, but it's happening, right? It's still happening now, right? And it has happened with me many times. I still remember not too long ago, just 4 years ago, when I had my second baby and I was ready to leave IBM to go to startup world. Obviously, you know, people say, what can we do to keep you in the company and don't leave, right? One of the things that I was told was, you're a new mom, someone told me, and it's perfectly, you know, fine, because maybe they had good thoughts about me being a new mom and taking care of my baby rather than going to this hectic startup world where I have to like work hours and, you know, do a lot more work than being in an established organization. I was told by somebody, can't remember, but they were like, are you sure you want to go in startup world when your baby is not even 1 year old? It's like, yeah, I'm sure, because I have a support system and I understand how to build a support system, not just with my partner, but also with all my friends and with my neighbors and with my family. I have maybe like half a dozen moms who stay at home, but they are in my support network, right? Because they chose to stay at home doesn't mean they cannot be in my support network as much as all the mentors and leaders that are in my support network too, right? So just having the support network. And so these things still happen, right? And we as leaders have to definitely, because we see it more, because we have experienced them, we see it more. And it's important for us to do the right thing at the moment, because they don't mean any harm, but they are not taught. They are not told that these subtle, even like the natural language, for example, saying in a production issue war room meeting, let's put our big boy pants up and do this. Like, it is a natural language. Maybe that's how you talk to your kids at home. But there is one woman engineer in the war room, and she's also trying to fix the production issue as much as all the other engineers, right? So, yeah, so these things still happen.
My absolutely most hated word is penetration testing. I hate that word. It's like, can we just call it pen testing? I'm done calling penetration testing. It is so jarring to me. Oh, every time I hear it, it's jarring.
I haven't heard that.
And I worked on security software. It was really hard. It's like, we're going to do pen testing. This is pen testing. It was so hard.
Which is for all of these things, it's just like, would the person have asked the same thing to a man? Like, would they have asked to a man who just got a baby, who wants to move to a startup, if he could do it? No, right? It's like, to me, that's really a simple framework effect when people are like, oh, I don't know, we can't say anything these days. We can't make sexist jokes anymore, you know? And it's like, well, yes, that's correct. First of all, you can't. And also, if you're not sure, to me, the framework is simple, is, would you be making the same comment or asking the same question if the person looked different? And so often for those microaggressions is the answer is no. They wouldn't ask the man who just had a new baby because, like, of course he can't do it, but they would ask the woman the same way, need to for you. Like, they wouldn't ask a man's CTO how he balances the responsibilities at home, right? So it's just, if the answer is no, you wouldn't be asking if it was someone else, or you wouldn't be making the same comment, then probably it means your comment is pointed and that you shouldn't make it. So I feel like that's actually not that hard when we think about it.
Now, it wouldn't be 2020 if we didn't talk about the giant elephant in the room, but obviously coronavirus has impacted people in plenty of awful and terrifying ways and has changed the way that the world looks indefinitely. And I mean, look at us all. Normally we'd be doing this in a room together. And, you know, now I watch TV and if anybody shakes hands, I'm like cringing. I'm like, wait, stop. But, you know, if we're looking at coronavirus and hiring priorities and, you know, the knock-on effect that's had on diverse candidates, you know, either when recruiting them or, you know, we talk about the Black Lives Matter movement and we talk about the actual trauma and stress that this has created for the BME community. Like, what kind of impact do you think that, you know, initially COVID, but, you know, 2020 in general has had on diverse candidates?
I think it's much worse. Statistically speaking, there's a huge correlation between diverse candidate and socioeconomic status. And I think they have fewer places to go and do work in a quiet space. They may have more distractions. They may have kids to take care of more often, or even if they have a support network, it may be just the environment at home when mom's at home or when dad's at home. It's playtime. You just saw my 10-year-old walk around because he's like, yeah, it's my house. I just go wherever I want. So I think it's actually gotten worse. And while I personally would absolutely love the whole work from home all the time thing, I think we have to create room and space where people can go to work if that is what they need. Because sometimes that may be, you know, that may be the quietest place that they can concentrate the most. And also, I think if you're hiring entry-level diverse candidates, they need to be with other people to like kind of learn the ropes at times, to like understand what a senior engineer does and, you know, how do they think through a problem? How do you whiteboard something? Like, I think those things need like real people interactions, and I think screens aren't as helpful. But it did open up like pretty much most of the world to recruit from. So that's good.
There are definitely some positives, like it opens up new opportunities, like new places from where you can hire. But also for everyone, like especially female engineers, like in my experience, what I have seen is that they're more confident because now everyone is rectangle in Zoom or Google Meet box, right? Like they are not so conscious about, oh, my hair, oh, my nail is chipping or whatever was in their mind before, or even being like a little bit shy in public speaking or talking in a room full of people looking at them. But I've seen some of these engineers in my team like outgrow that and be doing a lot of tech talks and presenting and speaking up more often in the meetings, where I actually would had to, you know, I used to tell them, you should speak up more because you had such a good idea, but you didn't say that in the meeting. But I'm seeing that more happening more and more. So in a way, it's also good for people who are already like female engineers, especially. But I agree with Neetu that there are, you know, there are pros and cons, and some of the things are not as great because everyone has a different situation right now. Like even with performance reviews, if everyone is reviewed on the same scale, how can you do that when everyone's situation is so different? right? It's such a difficult topic, especially in the HR folks. Whenever I talk to them, how are you going to handle performance reviews this year? It is just so hard to do it correctly.
That's a great point and something that a lot of people don't take into consideration. I mean, I spend all day, every day on LinkedIn, and LinkedIn is becoming quite a scary place. There are a lot of people that are incredibly vocal and supportive of, you know, different issues surrounding diversity, but it's also becoming a bit of a free-for-all, in almost like a Facebook, you know, in the sense of there is now an open platform where people are able to be outright racist, outright sort of like homophobic, like all of these sorts of issues that are coming along. And I'd be interested to know from like a, you know, a direct manager perspective, like, have you ever witnessed anything happening in a public domain, you know, an engineer or somebody in an employment position utilizing their platforms for reasons that they shouldn't have, or vocalizing thoughts that perhaps they definitely shouldn't have been, and how that's had a repercussion on, you know, the team internally?
So one thing that I've felt strongly about from since I started was just to really have in the interview process some questions and interviews focus on that person's ability to be an inclusive and respectful coworker, but really specific to diversity and inclusion. So we have some questions that are focus on that. So it's not just about hiring people from diverse backgrounds, but it's also about hiring great allies. And so sometimes I notice that people will be like, oh, well, really, we did everything we could to hire diverse for this role, but we couldn't. So we just hired someone not diverse. But it's not like one or nothing to me. You can try really hard and then it doesn't work out, but you hire an amazing ally. And one of our example I know for us was our COO search. We were really aware of our in the diversity at the higher level, and we did a search where we try and consider as many diverse candidates as possible. Didn't work out, so many reasons, timing, pool of candidates, of course, all of that. But we hired an amazing ally, and having him come in, and we had a 30-minute interview, him and I, on diversity and inclusion. What is he going to do? And really, like, real questions. What have you done before? Especially if you're a leader, you should be able to ask them what they've done before, because it's not, they should have thought about it before now. And having him come in has just made a huge impact. And we've together hired a 2 more C-level executive. We're both women and we're not 50-50. And so there's different paths to get to also more diversity. And sometimes it's through allyship and just leaders who really, really care about it, even if maybe they don't have, they're not themselves from an underrepresented group. So I think that's an angle to think about. And just to answer the actual question, through asking these questions, usually it means that the people that we hire have values that are aligned with us in terms of being respectful and caring about diversity and inclusion. Then, obviously, freedom of thoughts. But to me, the limit is pretty clear. It's the freedom of thoughts and expression, as long as you don't discriminate or make other people feel unsafe, especially the categories who have been made felt so unsafe and unwelcome for so long. So to me, the line is really clear here. Those are not behaviors that are welcome or tolerated.
You know, is there anything that, you know, Neetu, that you wish you were told when you were starting out your career in tech, that, you know, you've had to go on and learn the hard way by yourself?
One thing that I wish I had learned sooner rather than later was to experiment a lot more, and to take a lot more chances, and to be okay with failing, as long as I learned from the failure. If I didn't learn from the failure, then it was not worth it. And if I didn't take chances, then I was defining my own ceiling. So there are enough things in the world that will define a ceiling for me, but I didn't have to be one of them. And until I learned that it was okay to experiment, and I gave myself permission to experiment and try out things that were creative and dramatically different than everything I'd done before, and not worry not let the fear of failure paralyze me. I still hate failure. Do not get me wrong. I hate being wrong and I hate making mistakes, but I'm no longer paralyzed by it. I wish that was sooner.
There's a really great TED talk kind of what you're mentioning, which is we teach boys to be brave and girls to be perfect.
Yeah,
I would really recommend. And it's just so ingrained that failure is not okay for little girls and that risk is being discouraged, right? It's like, don't climb the thing. You're going to fall. Don't do this. Don't. And so it's just really hard to overcome even as an adult person, right? Because it's like little messages.
And I think my experiences are, if you know, being a woman, I'm sure there are other experiences from different backgrounds that have similar sets of things about how to conform, how to remain assimilated, how to not stick out. I wish I had worried a lot less about that earlier on than I did. I eventually caught up. I think I did. But yeah, along those lines, also another book called The Confidence Code, which I think is exactly the same strategy.
Mm. And Dalji, how about you? Anything that, you know, if you could go back in time and tell your younger self now, what advice would you?
Yeah, I think really understanding that you can speak up and not be afraid to speak up when you see something wrong. And it's almost similar to what you guys are talking about, how you are conditioned since being a girl since childhood. It has a bigger impact on you when you enter your adult life in a professional world. But really, I have learned this along the way that you can give feedback to anyone and not be afraid of it. If you see any signs of any subtle signs, or if you feel that something is wrong, right? And I think that's something that I learned recently after like spending several years in the industry, because initially it was always like, what if I speak up and I'm wrong? What if I speak up because everyone else is on one side and I have a different view? If I speak up, I might be wrong, and what will happen then, right? But really, to speak up when you feel like it and when you feel that you have an idea, speak up. And also don't be afraid to give feedback, whoever it is. So I have learned to give feedback very recently, like in last 6-7 years, and that has tremendously helped me.
And just two more questions from me here, guys, but I'd really love to know from my perspective, and to anybody, you know, that is in a HR or recruitment function, in your opinion, you know, Anna, we'll start with you. What more could, you know, in-house recruitment teams and staffing agencies actually be doing to help support diversity initiatives when hiring?
Yeah, I feel like I would say different answers for in-house versus agencies. Probably for the agencies, actually, that's when we work with agency, that's our request that we made anyway, is the first 10 candidates that we see for the search should first be prioritized from diverse background. I think the first candidates for a search are really important. It sets the tone for the search. They also have the advantage of being a little further along. And typically, I notice that's where we fall short, because if we look at who applied, or again, pipeline is still a little not equal. And so if we focus just on the easy candidates that come in right away, it might limit the number of people and backgrounds that we can actually consider. And so for agency, that's what I would say, is like, just send the first 5-10 people that are being presented. It also, again, helps change the mindset of like, oh, I didn't know we could find someone who looked like this for this role. Well, some companies hopefully have been thinking about it more, right? But it's still about changing people's mindset. And then internally for us, for me, is really just, again, thinking of putting a little bit extra work and a bit extra time to source the broadest pool of candidates in order to find the best person. And I know one argument sometimes that I'm always a little bit frustrated when I hear is, we don't want to lower the bar for diversity.
It's not about lowering the bar ever. We literally will raise the bar. We're going to present a broader pool of candidates, go after people that maybe are the best person that we would not have considered for really trivial reason, right? And then hire the best person even better. So not only we're not lowering, we're literally increasing the bar and hiring more diversity at the same time and creating more diverse team, which we know have better outcomes. So to me, it's just win-win-win. The only cost is a little bit of, I would say, thoughtfulness and just time spent, because it just takes a little bit thinking outside the box. And then there are a few things that I know I felt strongly about and that I think everyone can do, is just removing requirements that are not predictor of success. So something that we remove for all of our job description is a college degree, for example. And we've hired wonderful people who have not been to college. And that one has helped, I think, a lot for specifically for race diversity, because of, again, societal and systemic racism that creates inequality and the cost of college in the US and all of that. So I think just opens the door to more candidates. And we can also hire people who have PhD, but it's just about, again, diversity and just making sure people have equal access to opportunities and won't self-select out. Because as we know, women and minorities will self-select out if they don't meet as many of the requirements that a white man will feel more comfortable applying when they meet, you know, about 30%. And women and typically underrepresented minorities will apply when they meet closer to 80%, depending on the studies. So more requirements, the least diversity.
And just finally, what advice would you share to younger, more impressionable minorities, you know, in the audience or that are going to be listening, you know, to this podcast later on, just to encourage them to keep going and study in those STEM subjects and secure a career in tech?
Honestly, it's write code, make sure you have a profile I can review, and then get in front of people.
I think keep aside, at least yourself, keep aside thinking about who you are, what your background is, and see where you are going. If you think too much yourself that, oh, I'm a woman, I can't do this. Oh, I'm from a minority, I can't do this. It's going to be difficult. So keep that aside and stop thinking about that and think of, I want to be a software engineer, period, right? I want to get into coding, period. Doesn't matter what my background is. What do I need to become a software engineer? Do I need to attend a boot camp? Do I need to do certain trainings? Do I need to create my GitHub? Do I need to practice writing code or create a mobile app? Whatever it is, right? Do that rather than thinking, oh, I don't have any friends because I'm from this background. And I don't have any family who they don't even own a computer, or I don't have any friends who are in software engineering, or because, you know, I need to raise kids and I don't have time to code. So stop thinking to that yourself. I feel like the more you think, and this is where we were talking about subtleties, right? Whenever anyone reminds you about those subtleties in a conference room and you're a single woman in the room, that's when it hurts the most, because you're trying all the time to not think about that. You're trying to think about, hey, this is my presentation, this is my project, I'm going to talk about it. And someone reminds you about you being alone in the room, and quickly it hits you, right? So those are the things you need to change for sure.
And then I would also recommend networking, and again, because it can feel lonely to be thinking you don't have the right background, you don't know anyone, like just going on LinkedIn, now we have that, finding people who have maybe similar background to you who got into tech somehow, and networking with them, asking them what they did. And then I would also say just practicing for interviewing. I know I often will put notes on LinkedIn. I'm sometimes busier than I want to, and I can't always respond to everyone, but usually I'm happy to do that. Really practicing phone screens, reviewing resumes, and practice, because it's like anything else in life. We can't be good right away, and interviewing can be difficult, and applying to jobs can be difficult, and then asking for feedback as much as possible. Anytime an opportunity doesn't work out, and I know some recruiters don't like to share feedback, but a few will, and that's worth it. If you can try and get honest feedback and then refine, practice again and try again. That would be my advice.
Wonderful. Thank you, everyone, so much. I think we just had a question from Chris, if you're happy to answer. And I have just a couple of questions that some of the audience submitted previously. Chris, do you want to lead off with a question that you have for the panel?
Fantastic. This was wonderful. Thank you so much. Your stories were very compelling and moving, and it was interesting to hear your perspectives individually on the challenges of not only working in the corporate space as a woman, but also the challenges of raising a family. One of the questions that I had for the panel was around the management of those people that you do bring in that are diverse within a culture that may not be used to the diversity. How have you managed those folks that are either your second line managers that they've hired? You know, there's this push to bring these diverse minds into your organizations. How have you managed them to help manage? Because you probably have the wherewithal, but do your managers have the wherewithal?
So I can go. I actually have seen, I'll give you an overall view of how I approach management, and also I'll give you a specific example. So I think what anybody in my team needs from me is custom to that person. I think it's custom to that. I have, you know, I have, whether it's white men, whether it's women, whether it's people of different colors, whether it's other backgrounds, whether it's immigrants from places that are different than here, what people need from me is very different. And I try very hard to help them navigate their career to the point that they want it to go. That's what I do one-on-one directly with them. So that would mean, like, it doesn't matter. You know, I try to apply the same rule to everyone, because, like, I think even if I have a white man reporting to me, I feel just as much responsibility to that white man as I might to the Black woman who's reporting to me. So it to me personally, as a manager, I feel the same level of responsibility. Where it does differ is when I'm in conversations where other people express, you know, a performance feedback or a feedback that may not be directly performance related, but may have an unconscious bias bend to it. And I can't honestly say I catch all of them, because I'm not immune to bias myself. I don't know that anybody is, but when I catch it, I almost 100% of the time correct it. This happened to, like, women directors in my team, where if they are speaking up, you know, for their features, their emotions are called into conversations way more often than men directors. So I almost always go and correct it. So I can't say that I'm always, that I catch it all the time, but I certainly try. That's, and I think, like, the feedback I give them is also different. So, like, for the women directors, I will tell them, here, go to this link and apply for go talk at this conference. I don't have to do that for men. Or in, like, other places, if we're doing a salary review, I will not just review the salary for the people who've asked for it. I will review everybody's, and that I've definitely caught disparities in salaries for people. And then I try to establish a rubric that's independent of the differences. And just and then one of the things that I always try to do is, in every organization that I'm in, the first thing I go for is actually the definition of different levels in a ladder. Definition of different levels in the ladder is literally the contract you have with the person. And the more specific you are, the more achievable, more defined you can make it, then you can make it more measurable. At which point, if you led a project that had these characteristics, you get this, like, then it's a math problem. Otherwise, it's not a math problem. The more I can make it a math problem, the less bias I will have to deal with.
Thanks, me too. So I have a question from Max Saltonsoul. He's a director of engineering at Google, and he's asked two questions. He said, how do you make an early stage candidate evaluation more equitable? And what makes an interview panel more inclusive?
There, I can share a few things. One thing we've done for the early stage is we try and do an assessment as much as possible as a first step before the phone screen. And I know there's been, you know, back and forth on how, if it feels respectful enough to not even talk to the person first, but my view on this, and now I have the data to see, is that it's improved diversity so much because it removes, we're not looking at the experience as much because the time commitment is not the same, right? A 30-minute phone screen is, we can only do so many screens. But in this case, we can send the assignment to 80% of the applicant if we wanted to. And just anyone who has something on their resume, maybe it's not traditional, maybe it's not, you know, exactly the right background, but we can give them a fair shot. And by doing that, we've done that for a lot of roles on our sales team, for example, and it's just honestly paid off amazingly. So that's been, to me, one advice I would say is just assessments, because people can showcase what they're capable of instead of us maybe just getting blocked by the resume not being perfect. And then for interview panel, as soon as I started, we were only 50 employees, but I said that the minimum rule should be a never an all male panel. To me, that's the minimum rule. And I really think unless there's literally zero women in the whole company, which I don't know, maybe that's another discussion, but to me, that should be doable. And then we can work from there. And it should be more than that. It should be not all white. It shouldn't be, you know, we can work from there. But to me, that's the minimum rule, is never an all male panel. And then unconscious bias training as much as possible. And we can do one big training and then just reiterating regularly. So we do unconscious bias training for every new hires within their first 3 months. And my team and I are the one leading that. And so that's, I think, is a first step to just raising awareness, being aware that this is the case. And then having really structured interviews. So again, having very specific questions, way to assess what a good answer is. So we don't leave it to just chit chat and gut feeling of like, oh, I really vibe to this person. That's not a scorecard, right? Like, that's not a good feedback. It's like, tell me what their skills were. What did you evaluate? How does this compare to other candidates? And then we can really compare candidates to remove bias. So those would be my main tips.
Great. Thank you. And then lastly, we have a question from Michael DeRose. He's the head of customer success at RapidSOS. And he was asking the panel if there's a framework that exists that companies can use to form and maintain an effective DE&I committee. Michael's company is smaller and fairly new to the concept. So he's looking for ways to make a newly formed committee more successful.
I can just share my experience, and then I'm sure Anna has more experience on this, so she can answer it better. But in terms of like from engineering point of view, I think it has to be both ways. So wherever I've been, I've always tried to do one grassroots level and one pushing the leadership. So from top and from bottom, both sides. So in terms of being from top is like having a head of diversity and having budget for all these events or things like that, and having metrics or data-driven goals for hiring, recruitment, and retention, things like that. But from grassroots, really participating in just simple examples like participating in Women Who Code Hackathon or being a host of a Women Who Code meetup, which are like free meetups. But definitely, I've hired many candidates, women candidates like that in the past, where first time they came to the office was in one of the events that I hosted. Right. So from the grassroots level, it's important to have your female engineers and engineering managers engaged so that they can also, you know, showcase the company culture. So I feel like it has to be on the both sides.
Yeah, I totally agree. And depending on the company size, so the way we did it when I first started, we were 50 and now we're 200. So it's pretty different. But when we were 50, I started
D&I committee, and it was open to all. And I thought that was pretty important because we were small enough that I knew it wouldn't be huge anyway, right? But quickly we got like a third of the company became part of that committee, and it included allies, which I think that's a key part to me. A committee should always include allies. It shouldn't be just women and minorities doing all of the work to make it more equitable. And we met every week for 30 minutes, talk about just regular things like language in the office, something we caught that seems to be not working, and then really quickly got into reporting. So every quarter, I started sending to the whole company the representation breakdown per level so that we can track progress and stay accountable. And then everyone in the committee start having an ownership into it, right? So kind of the grassroots approach is so important because they go into their department and they start like just thinking more and more about it. And now that we're 200, we switched that to a core team, what we call a core team, and there's 10 people, and it's two representative of each of the major departments, while also making sure we have diversity within the committee. So same thing, we meet every week. We'll talk about initiatives, things we're working on, and track and reports on progress.
Wonderful. Well, I'm super appreciative of all of you taking the time. It has been an honest pleasure to listen to you, to hear your experiences. And I think it's been wonderful, and there's a lot of value to be shared with the community from this. So if you're all happy, I think we can wrap up and end our Thursday on, for me at least, an incredibly positive note.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was so nice to meet you all too.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.